So this session is going to be about new ways of measurement because some of the initial sighting measurements on the topologic insulators have been difficult measurements, but of course now we're going to hear about what are obviously more difficult measurements, transport measurements. From Quan Ong. So we'll hear from Quan, then we'll hear briefly from Patrick Lee. I don't know whether there's a natural order for Marcus Koenig and Nathan Nagosa. Maybe we'll hear from Marcus and then Nagosa. I would say we can plan for about 17 minutes and then questions that.
Okay. So let me thank the speaker. Thank the organizers. Is this on? Maybe that's why. Yeah, it's on. It's too bad. So that was recorded. So these are my students. I apologize for not talking about topological insulators, but graphene is not too bad. It was a prototype for a lot of these ideas. And maybe the measurements I'm going to talk about may give us some way to get at the topological states that's of interest here. So these are the two students who are actively involved in this. Lou looks happy because he has graduated. And Joe is still with me, so maybe he doesn't look so happy. But the two of them have actually done an excellent job in this project. So I'm going to talk about mostly on the thermopower and the Nernst effect. And if time permits, probably not. I'll update you on this divergence of the resistance at the Dirac point. I'll spend most of my time on the first topic. So just to remind you quickly, so as Novoselov and Geim at first, and then Kim and Zhang showed, graphene shows beautiful integer Hall, quantum Hall effect. So the sigma xy has this curious half-shifted integer due to the Berry phase at the Dirac point, and this is now by now very well known. You have these quantum Hall steps. In this particular sample, which actually has a very high mobility, you can actually see the zero step at the Dirac point, even in rather modest field of about 14 Tesla. And what we found is that the Dirac resistance at the Dirac point diverges very rapidly, which is a point that I'll come back to at the end of the talk. So to do thermal power, did I skip a slide? Let me see. No. To do thermal power, we adopted the technique first pioneered by Phil Kim for nanotubes. You deposit a gold wire, which acts as your heater, and then two more gold wires, which in this case also serve as the current leads. So you notice these are four probes so that you can measure the intrinsic resistance of these two gold wires very accurately because they're going to serve as your thermometry. The Hall probe and as well as for the Nernst experiments are shown here. I'm not sure you can see the graphene sample. It's very faint. You can see a very sharp cusp here and a sharp cusp here. Right? So this is about usually 10 to 20 microns, more likely 10 microns. I forget what the number is here. And so the width is roughly 3 to 4 microns.
So the heater wire does not contact for
it? No. Let me say a little bit about it. So all it does is that it heats up the silicon oxide and drives the heat current. But the problem we have here is because we have to have the thickness of the silicon oxide a certain thickness, which is quite large, actually, 300 nanometers, and that's because of the need to do contrast interference to see the graphene. And that presents a tremendous problem. Most of the heat actually wants to flow vertically into the screen. And by a long process of trial and error, we finally got the heat to flow where we think it's flowing, as you see from the data. So three groups simultaneously. Sorry.
How linear is the thermal gradient? How linear is the thermal gradient?
We can only measure it by looking at the voltage drop, and it scales beautifully with the heater power. But we cannot Yeah, we don't have enough leads to tell you how. It's probably, the hot spot is here, right? So most of the heat goes in, and that's sort of a decrease, like a Gaussian spot over the... So in the early nanotube experiments, Phil Kim's group could use very thin substrates because he didn't have a constraint, right? And he could drive the heat down longitudinally. But here we had to do a lot of calculations on the substrate conductance. One trick was to lay out the gold leads to help improve the conductance on the surface. But eventually the trick that worked best was to do AC. So we oscillate the heater current by about 5 hertz, and that really removed a lot of the extraneous signals. Three groups started doing these experiments about a year ago, and we have simultaneously completed, well, more or less the same, converged to roughly the same result. So I'll talk about mine. The three groups are Kim's group and then a group at Riverside. So the zero field thermal power looks like this. As you increase the temperature sitting at the maximum, you see that's beautifully T-linear. With a very large value, it's about 100 microvolts per Kelvin at room temperature, which is 10 times larger than conventional metals, perhaps not surprising since you're close to the Dirac point. If you sweep the gate voltage, it shows the charge asymmetry as you would expect, right? Thermal power changes sign with charge. And moreover, as I mentioned, if you double the gradient, you double the signal. So we are convinced this is just purely the intrinsic thermal power of graphene. The Mott equation, which links the thermal power to the derivative of sigma versus mu, is roughly obeyed. But my students tell me that there's a factor of 2 discrepancy, which we're trying to sort out. So to within a factor of 2, it scales like the derivative of the conductance versus, not the gate voltage, but versus the chemical potential, which you can get by computing the capacitance of the layer. So all three groups agree on this shape. The thermal power in the field is, of course, much more interesting, and we get signals that are much larger than reported by the other groups. Here is the 9 Tesla thermal power at 20 Kelvin. And first of all, you expect it to follow the Landau level splitting, and it does. Sorry, this is in green. But if you can work out the green trace is the conductance G sub XX after you convert from resistivity tensor. And you see some sub-level structure, which in the end turned out to be not of physical significance, as I'll show towards the end of the talk. So this corresponds to n equals minus 1 plus 1 plus 2 minus 2, right? And as the field increases, the levels spread out like your fingers, as expected. So nothing very surprising here. The Nernst signal is perhaps less intuitive. It has a very large value, about 30 microvolts per Kelvin in cuprates, even in the vortex liquid. This number would be of the order of 10 microvolts per Kelvin. So it's very large, larger than the thermal power. And it has the following form. As you go through the peak in the density of states at the n equals 1 Landau level, it has this dispersive form, right? Rather than reaching a peak, it actually takes a dispersive form, which actually agrees with a previous calculation by Gervin and Johnson.
How's the Mott relation in the sigma?
It doesn't hold at all, yeah. So once you get edge currents, the Mott relationship doesn't hold. I'll come back to that. Okay, so let me remind you of the various constitutive equations. So the quantity, this has no name, unfortunately, so I like to call it the thermoelectric conductivity. The quantity that relates current density to temperature gradient is called alpha. this is the fundamental thing of interest, although this is not what you measure directly, right? So to walk you through that a little bit, that, so when you have an open boundary finite sample, the electric field is set up by charge buildup, so you have to combine electric field tensor, the conductivity tensor, with this quantity of interest, and that's your total current density. So because of the open boundaries, you set this to zero, and then that allows you to solve for the electric field. So E sub x along the gradient direction is your thermal power, but notice that it's defined with a minus sign. And if you invert these matrices, it has this form, right? So there's the diagonal terms. I'll drop xx from now on. I'll just call them by the single Greek letter. Plus this off-diagonal term, which normally in a bad metal doesn't come in at all. It's very small. But in the quantum Hall regime, this is in fact the dominant term. This is zero to leading approximation. And then more interestingly, the Nernst effect is this particular combination. So to get at that quantity of interest to a theorist, let's say, you can actually invert these equations because you have measured Ex and Ey, right? So you can invert it, and this is the result. So at the end, I'm going to talk mostly about alpha xy, but alpha xy is an inferred quantity from the experiment because we have measured sigma xy, Ex, and Ey. Now, to motivate the experiment a little bit, let me remind you of this calculation done a long time ago by Gervin and Johnson for quadratic dispersion quantum Hall regime. So the idea is the following. If you have edge currents, then you know they took an infinite sample along the y direction. So when you apply a gradient this way, the edge currents in the y directions do not contribute, and therefore Ix is zero. But along I sub y, this is warmer than that, and therefore there will be an imbalance in the edge currents. And the result is that, you know, so this is the edge current on the left, let's say, at a given temperature. This is the edge current at the right with another temperature. The difference will be your net current in the y direction, right? So this translates into alpha xy, which they then calculate to be simply this. So it's this characteristic difference of Fermi-Dirac distributions. And so then these currents, because they are unbalanced, set up an electric field. That electric field in turn drives a current in the original direction because of the quantized Hall effect. So by conflating two off-diagonal effects, you finally get a thermal power, which then becomes purely off-diagonal, right? Remember my comment about this term being insignificant. And so that's what they get in the end. So this is in the limit when the Landau levels are very narrow, no impurities, and you get very sharp edge currents, very well-defined edge currents. So this is the thermal power that they compute. But their calculation doesn't hold for the Dirac point. In fact, they're completely silent on that for obvious reasons. But that's where our interests are.
So is this for integer?
Yes. So the peak value can be, you can easily do this in your head, and you can find out that this whole thing reduces to log 2 times t, which cancels that and gives you kb log 2. So keep this in mind. Except now you have n plus a half, but because of the shift of the Berry phase in the Dirac system, this half should not be there, I believe.
And this log 2 has nothing to do with it.
Entropy or something. No. It's a Mott formula type. It's this exact integral.
So in the integer quantum Hall, this has been measured?
Experimentally, it's been measured, yeah. So there are not very many, two papers. And they sort of verify this, but not in a very detailed fashion. But this is not the interesting part. So what I want to talk about is here. Yeah. All right, so now I put the three fields together in one panel, all at 20 Kelvin. We have trouble going below 20 Kelvin for the following interesting reason. Once you go to like 10 Kelvin, you see giant universal conductance fluctuations, and they are much larger than the thermal power signal itself. And we're trying to get around that. You know, it's this magnetic fingerprint, right, that Patrick and others discussed many, many years ago. They're very big for reasons that we don't understand, and they are absolutely reproducible. So far, we have stopped at 20 Kelvin. All right, so here's 5 Tesla, and you already see the Landau levels clearly defined. 9 Tesla, they spread apart, some hints of some structure here, and then at 14 Tesla, they're farther apart. So a number of things that I want to draw your attention to. Once you go to high fields, the magnitude doesn't change very much, right? And this is consistent with Gervin Johnson's calculation. Furthermore, it becomes very weakly temperature dependent. 50 Kelvin and 20 Kelvin, the green curve, doesn't change very much. So the temperature dependence is almost non-existent. The field dependence is also non-existent. So we are sort of probing the quantum edge current properties. What about the Nernst effect? Again, 5 Tesla, 9 and 14. And you see this giant Nernst signal become very large. But it's not very temperature dependent. And as I said, you see this dispersive character very, very well.
So you're claiming dispersive character, but on the other side...
Here the sample is less well behaved. We don't really understand it. In both the electrical transport, this side is... That's always true in our graphene samples. One side is better behaved than the other.
And it's always the holes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But there was some discussion. So.
All right. Okay. I won't be going to tell you about the divergence of the resistance. So you can unfold this data and compute alpha xy, right? So remember the Johnson calculation. Alpha was zero, so alpha xy. But look how clean alpha xy is now. Especially at high fields, it's zero between the Landau levels, just like the calculation. Has a peak, it's no longer dispersive. So this actually matches pretty well the Johnson-Gervin calculation. So the anomaly is that the sign is different at the Dirac point. At n equals zero, these ideas don't work at all. You get the opposite sign. It points down. Everywhere else, it points up. I won't talk about alpha xx. It's less interesting. And this is the main anomaly that I wanted to discuss. Now, why is this puzzling? Let me quickly walk you through that. So that's the data. In the semi-classical regime, you can have a mod-like relationship in Boltzmann transport between alpha xy and sigma xy. And it's just a derivative with respect to mu, right? So, but if the sigma xy is quantized, and it is, then this expression should just give you a comb of peaks, somewhat like that. And at zero, you still have the same sign, right? So clearly, this is a problem, right? And so you say, okay, well, this is in the classical regime, so let's talk about the Gervin-Johnson calculation. So this is, again, is the expression they got, the difference of the two edge currents, and the idea is the following, right? If you have a Landau level at the boundaries, they go up, and then on the warm side, the Fermi-Dirac distribution is broader, whereas on the cool side it's sharper, then this multiplied by the derivative gives you one of these sort of up-down curves, right? Sinusoidal, which cancels to zero unless your mu overlaps one of the Landau levels. So here I've shown it moving just past it. Then you can easily see that if it sits at the bottom here, you should get a very large peak. And this is how Gervin and Johnson obtained this peak. But in extending this to the Dirac point, you sort of have a problem, because does this bend down or does this bend up, right? Or is it a combination as in the MIT and, well, the counter-propagating mode of many people, many groups have proposed that, where, you know, half of it bends down, half bend up. But then you still wouldn't solve this. You still wouldn't get a negative going peak. So this is an interesting anomaly that is telling us something about the edge currents at the Dirac point. And so I sort of run out of time. Let me just jump to the summary. So we see a large thermal power and known signal and an interesting sign anomaly in alpha xy. And the Gervin-Johnson theory is valid for all these levels except the interesting one. Thank you.
Correct on saying that you are associating this opposite sign to the prediction in the fractional quantum Hall effect in some states where you have this neutral counter-propagating modes that would add to your
No. I'm saying that yeah, you mean the counter-propagating the pair of counter-propagating
yeah,
modes that wouldn't work either. That was my point.
That it may be due to that?
In my, I discussed with Patrick earlier this morning, it doesn't seem like it should, because see, the counter-propagating mode is you would just get this. Right, so that if you park your mu here, those are your two counter-propagating modes, right? But then when you start calculating the edge current contribution, make this side warmer and this side cooler, you would still get I'm not sure what you'd get. One part is that they will cancel exactly, give you zero, which to Patrick is half the battle won. But you know, you need a negative signal. So the reason for converting this to alpha xy is because theorists do not like to calculate the Nernst effect, because there are four quantities. So what we've done is we've approached you halfway by measuring all the quantities that we can measure, and we're giving you alpha xy. So this is linear response, right? So this ought to be an easier problem. We're giving you a lot of information. So this should be hopefully a solvable problem.
But all those theories are strongly dependent on ignoring interactions.
Correct.
How strongly are the interactions important in the Dirac point, right? And
that's right.
They're much more important, right?
Yeah.
So you said you had an update on the divergence of R0. Could we?
Yeah, we have some new data. You want to see it?
Yeah. I mean, it's an open discussion.
So, all right. So this is the old paper that appeared a few months ago. Where am I? So you sit here, you see this very strong divergence. If you sit at the Dirac point, you see that it goes up. And here's one sample where it goes up to 200 kilo ohms at 0.3 Kelvin at a relatively modest field of about 14 Tesla. And we found out that actually what stops many experiments from seeing this divergence is self-heating. So we took care of that, and we used a new method that reduced the self-heating to femtowatts. Because picowatt is about how much the sample tolerates at 0.3 Kelvin. Because remember, these are just single mono layers of carbon. When you go to femtowatt dissipation, you see this... to me, you know, it looks like it's just astonishing. It just goes vertically upwards from a quantum of resistance, like 10 kilo ohms. Here I'm plotting 20 mega ohms. The data actually extends to 40 mega ohms, as you can see from the log plot here. Right, so within a few Tesla, it reaches 40 mega ohms. So it goes from a metal to an insulator. But you have to go to low temperatures to see that. At 5 Kelvin, it's rather slower. This is an expansion of what happens down here, a factor of 200 expansion, or 100 in the scale. So this we had posted a few months ago, but recently Joe has taken a lot more samples to that high field. And here you see five samples. The takeoff is less impressive because this is on log scale, right? But remember, this is three decades. This is a sample that appeared in the PRL. You know, these two measurements stop at 200 kilo ohms. These were taken up to 40 mega ohms. The reason you can't go above 40 mega ohms because your pre-amp input impedance is 100 mega ohm, and since these are AC methods, that's a problem, right? And so this seems to be quite reproducible. The divergence fit to the Koslitz-Thouless divergence is also quite satisfactory. It's more noisy in the new samples. But you notice that the slope is the same.
Yes.
So they're all behaving in the same way with the same kind of divergence with different critical fields.
So the KT parameter, the B, is the same?
It's the same, yeah. To within you notice that this would be extremely sensitive to what you choose for the critical field, right? So we haven't tried to fix that. We could fix that by making them exactly equal, but we haven't tried to do that.
Okay.
This is how the temperature dependence goes. As you warm down at fixed field, always sitting at a Dirac point for one of those newer samples. This burned a lot of power, and we got a lot of bad fan mail from the National Magnet Lab, because this scan at 30 Tesla means they're burning about something like a 50 kilowatts of power over the time it took to go up the field, and they were kind enough to let us continue. So the gap that you infer from that is large, about 30 Kelvin, sort of near the critical field, but then it plunges. You know, it plunges, but it doesn't quite go to zero. So we don't know what to make of that. You know, it looks like a gap does open up, but it's not. It doesn't close at the critical field. It continues on into the quote metallic state. So that's the new data.
Somebody who's completely ignorant, can you explain why you tried the KT bit to begin with?
Well, we tried various things. So, you know, power law doesn't work, right? Because KT is much more divergent. So we abandoned all power laws, and then the next thing was exponential. And the only thing we know of, that I know of, that is divergent with an exponential increase, was KT. So the exponent could be different. It could be e to the 1 minus h to some other exponent other than a half. But we'll have to see how well that treats.
Like you have some sort of superconductivity in mind or anything like
that? No. But, you know, any 2D, any 2D XY model would do it.
I see.
Yeah.
And this the field here occurs larger than the one you measured for the Nernst effect.
That's right. Yeah, so that sample would be comparable to one of these. And so it would be, we stop, for the Nernst effect, we stop here. We can't go below 20 Kelvin anyway because of the universal fluctuation. But it would be nice to go to very high fields, yeah.
How far off from the Dirac point are you to start with?
How far off from the?
From the Dirac point are you to start with?
Am I?
Like when you start, how disordered is your sample? What's the Fermi level roughly? How much gate voltage do you have to put?
For the Nernst experiment,
yeah.
It's about 10 volts. I think it was shown in the I think it was you could read it off from the right. So it's 10 volts, right? So the critical field for a 10 volt sample is roughly 25 Tesla.
So is there a connection between this and this super insulated story by Shahar and Bakurin?
Super insulated. That requires a superconductor, doesn't it?
Well, supposedly there was an electron, but at least chronologically it looks pretty similar, right? So it's functionally.
Yeah, but there's nothing superconducting in here, you know. It's a divergent.
Well, who knows what it is there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, some people think.
Or the indium oxide experiments. Okay. It's hard to say.
Is there any phonon drag contribution to your zero power?
Phonon?
Drag? This is the dominant voltage requires, for example.
Sorry, you mean phonon drag?
Thermal power. Yes.
Thermal power?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, these are all in the quantum Hall regime, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you can have phonon drags.
I don't know. We can discuss that, but I don't.
So maybe we'll move on to having Otis Petri. Are you ready to?
Oh, well, I'm not ready, but that's stop. So,
let's thank Juan.
Yeah, it's fine. As long as it doesn't block the So Yeah, Shoshang asked me to make some comments on graphene. On originally, I was going to do it on Thursday, but it's fine. Yeah, I think it's more economical since Juan just talked about graphene, just for me to say a few words, and besides, it saves me the trouble of preparing for something on Thursday. And I was reading King and Mei-Li's paper several years ago, and it occurred to us that the same edge structure can be realized in graphene in a very easy way, because in graphene, if the edge state, because of particle symmetry, one must go up, the other one must go down, right? Because there's no bottom, right? Unlike conventional quantum hole where you have a really asymmetric structure, in graphene you must have fully symmetric structure. So when you get to the middle, there's a zero mode, and one goes up, one goes down, and then it doesn't take much to imagine that if you have a spin splitting, then you have this kind of structure, right? And so in the middle, you have enough spin going down, and or whatever, you have these kind of propagating edge modes. Now, of course, there's the other possibility that. So this splitting is exchange splitting, and the other possibility is that the exchange splitting split the modes first, and then the spin splitting follows. And in this case, then you don't have this thing at the Fermi energy, and you have a gap, right? And so
if
you gradually change the amount of
crossing point is removed.
If you have spin orbit, if you don't have spin orbit.
Oh.
Yeah, no spin orbit. Yeah, so this is just just spin orbit.
So at the spin orbit, yeah. They are adiabatically connected.
Yeah, so we don't know which. So what happens depends on the exchange, whether the exchange splitting between the spin is bigger or between the valleys is bigger. And we had assumed that this would be bigger because Zeeman certainly favors this term. And my original motivation of studying this is that here you have a relatively simple way of realizing this kind of propagating edge excitations, and maybe one can do experiment on this more easily than in the topological insulator. Now my expectation turns out to be totally wrong, opposite, because now these experiments were done more beautifully in the bismuth and antimony system. And here we run into all kinds of problems, particularly thanks to Huan Hong's inconvenient experiments. So for example, one of the predictions you make here is that the rho xx should go to this universe where 2e squared over h, right? Or sigma xx at the origin. Now, this has been beautifully seen in the experiments we heard about last time. But in graphene, this resistance seems to keep rising as you increase the magnetic field, right? And eventually it goes over to this gap situation. So then that raises the question whether,
What about the non-local?
Yeah, yeah. That raises the question of, are we actually over here where you really have a gap? Are these edge states in existence? Well, there are two. The way to check this is, of course, non-local transport. And Geim actually has seen non-local transport a year or two ago. He starts showing this data. And, of course, non-local transport was also reported last week. Unfortunately, the data here, he never published it, but the data here is rather too non-local to be. In the following sense, that the non-local effect persists up to very high temperature, even room temperature, right? So now I don't really understand why it should be non-local. At room temperature, well, these gaps are not expected to be that big.
Patrick, do you know what field and temperature he went down to?
Down to?
Yeah, what temperature?
I don't know the lows, but he always sees this non-local. It's the trouble is not the low temperature, it's the high temperature. That this non-local effect persists even the room temperature at modest fields like 20 Tesla and so on. Yeah, I have his slides somewhere. But
is he just qualitatively talking about non-local?
No, he measures it. No, he measures.
But there's some lot of beautiful formula. There's precise quantitative.
Yeah, he measures it.
The edge state picture is correct.
Well, it has to be edge state because it's really highly non-local.
Oh.
And the trouble is that the temperature dependence is very slow.
But is it quantized?
Yes.
Is it quantized or is it?
No, no, nothing is quantized. He just sees, So I think the things are kind of up in the air. The fact that there is a non-locality, I always say, kind of favors this. And also there's indirect evidence from Phillips Kim's group that by studying the transverse field, perpendicular field dependence of the next state, they inferred that that was orbital splitting. And therefore, by inference, this first one should be spin splitting. So there are these two indirect
pieces of evidence. So are they contradicting each other? I mean, so at low temperature is the divergence of the resistance, does that contradict the...
So at face value, it will contradict this picture. And so now there are other possibilities, of course. And so one possibility is that there is a phase transition to something else entirely, right? There may be many body effects driving, some instability. This could even be in the bulk. So even the bulk state could have some instability that then, of course, totally change your edge structure. So it's possible that this picture still works at low field, right below your threshold field that you have this.
No, I think when we saw the thermal power sub-level structure, right, we thought that it could be your crossing.
Yeah.
But then after you unfold it into alpha XY, they're all gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's it.
Right. Since I just saw Juan's this thermal measurement this morning, and through our discussion, I think that could be relevant because I think in this picture, then I think you have no chance but getting the conventional positive sign. Now in this picture, then I think you zero order. I think you should get zero, right? Because you see this whole Girvan mechanism, it's relying on the fact that we have highly particle asymmetry. So because when your Fermi level is here, right? So basically you're heating up one side. Let's set this side to be zero. So you're heating up this side, right? So this side is still in thermal equilibrium, but it's hot. Just by being hot, you can carry a current. And that's because these guys are moving one way. You have just by being hot, you can carry a current. But here, you have a symmetric situation. Your particle is symmetry. So you should get zero. Right. So that's why I claim I've solved half your problem. Right. So at least you don't get this big peak. You don't expect to get
but
peak.
The current is equally large.
Yeah. You should get zero. So now why would it change sign is a homework problem for for the audience. Yeah.
Regarding the counter-propagating mode, is there any reason that they do not narrow
the hybridize? No, in this case, spin orbit will go. Spin orbit will open a gap already. Yeah, so it's not protected by time reversal.
Interaction can also open a small gap.
Yeah, interaction in principle can open a gap.
Each space, the same side, they interact.
Yeah, in principle, all kinds of things can open gaps.
So regarding the picture that you presented where you have Zeeman splitting, is it known from the experiments whether the direction of the field matters? So obviously you need to produce a quantum Hall.
For the thermal power or for the...
We haven't
done the experiment with enough confidence to say.
Yeah, it's
expensive
to get time. Yeah.
Okay.
So, thanks very much. So, Marcus Koenig will talk now about some ideas for new experiments to probe edge states.
Okay. Here we are. Yeah, I think it's just for the recording, I trust. Okay. So, yeah. As David already said, I'd like to present some ideas for experiments we want to do on mercury telluride samples we get from Würzburg. And at Stanford, we plan to study the edge state of the quantum spin Hall effect in mercury telluride with a technique called scanning gate microscopy. For all those of you who haven't been here last week for Lawrence talk, I'd just like to give a short overview about the available experiment results for the mercury telluride samples, where first of all, it should be known that the quantum spin Hall effect has been observed in mercury telluride quantum worlds with an inverted band structure, and that the observed conductance is close to the, or is at the quantized value of 2 E squared over H in conductance, while samples with a normal band structure show diverging resistance in the insulating regime. In more recent experiments, it has been shown in non-local measurement configurations that the transport is indeed based on edge states, where it has been shown very conclusively, because for all kinds of contact configurations in the experiment, the observed resistance for the quantum spin Hall regime matches the theoretical prediction from the Landauer-Brüdiger formalism. Okay. However, if we go to non-perfect samples, like, for example, as we get them, if we increase the sample size, as for this sample with a size of 20 microns, we see that we get a deviation from the quantized conductance and end up with a finite conductance, which is, for this size of sample, for a length of 20 microns, roughly around 0.2, 0.3 E squared over H, depending on the actual sample, which is still several orders of magnitude below the result which we get for samples with a normal band structure, which we take as an indication that there is the quantum spin Hall effect states are still present, but somewhat disturbed. If we now go to an external magnetic field, we see a sharp decrease of the conductance for a perpendicular magnetic field, and an anisotropy with the direction of the magnetic field. So if we go to an in-plane field, the suppression of the conductance is much weaker, but still present. And if we go to magnetic fields perpendicular to the quantum world layer, we need field strength of the order of, say, 10 millitesla to get a very sharp decrease, or very significant decrease, of the conductance. If we look at all these experimental data, there are still several questions which are somewhat open. First of all, the non-local measurements show that their transport is indeed due to edge state as predicted in theory. But one of the questions is, for example, what's the width of the edge states? How close are they related to the actual edge of the sample? And it's been just published some theoretical work last week where it shows that if the sample gets too narrow, then the edge states of the opposite edges overlap, and which opens up a transport gap, and there the length scale for which this gap is predicted to open up is of the order of several 10 to 100 nanometers. Other questions relate to the stability of the quantum spin Hall edge states. First of all, what is the mechanism behind the suppression of the conductance we see in larger samples? Right now the idea is that there is some scattering due to potential fluctuations, and as you all already last week, the one possibility might be some fondue impurities in the sample. Another idea is that screening of the top gate, which is used to drive the sample to the quantum spin Hall state, induces some local two-dimensional puddles in the electron gas, where then the counterpropagating edge states can interact and possibly equilibrate. And the further question is, what happens in magnetic field? How far are the edge states affected? Are they still there? Is still some transport going on in magnetic field? Or how do the edge states behave in an external magnetic field when the time reversal symmetry is broken? The technique we want to use to study the quantum spin Hall state is scanning gate microscopy, which has been used for studying current flow in high mobility gallium arsenide 2-dex, at least that's the case for our group up to now. And so up here you see a schematic picture of the experimental setup. The green plane is a two-dimensional electron gas. These yellow shapes are metal gates which have been used to define the current flow through a quantum point contact. And here you see a charged AFM tip, which then induces a potential perturbation in the two-dimensional electron gas. Using this technique, the current flow out of a quantum point contact could be mapped with very good spatial resolution. Here the scaling bar is 1 micron. For all the other pictures, the scaling bar is 200 nanometers, so you get spatial information about the current flow coming from this point contact with a resolution of maybe 50 nanometers, which is pretty good. So, and we'd like to use this technique for to study the transport of the quantum spin Hall edge states, and the principles of the scaling gate microscopy can be explained in a rather simple way. If we use our charged AFM tip, we induce some perturbation in our two-dimensional electron gas, which is green here, and this perturbation happens in some place where no current is flowing. We won't see any signal change in the conductance. If we now bring this perturbation into the current path, but further scattering within the sample allows the electrons to reach the other side of the sample, we still don't see any change of the conductance. And that's the reason why in the gallium arsenide 2-deck experiments, a point contact has been used, because in this case, if the electrons get backscattered through the quantum point contact, we can detect a decrease of the conductance, which is then taken as an indication of the perturbation of the current flow. If we now go to the quantum spin Hall state, we can pretty easily transfer these cartoon pictures to the system. If you induce a perturbation somewhere in the bulk of the sample where no current is flowing, because the current is limited to the edges, we don't expect any change of the conductance of the signal. However, if we move this perturbation to the edge where actually the edge states are flowing, then we might induce some scattering, which then will directly lead to backscattering towards the source contact on this side, and then we'll see a decrease of the conductance.
Your tip is going to be time reversal breaking?
In the first experiments, we just need to use a charge tip, which then will only induce a potential fluctuation. So this, well, I think I can go.
But you may induce the electron part of it.
Yes, so I think I'll have it on this side. So, well, in principle, there are several possibilities how we actually might induce scattering. The first thing is that we might induce some kind of 2D reservoirs where the electrons of the counterpropagating states can interact. And it has been seen in the transport experiments that, for example, additional contacts or additional voltage probes to the quantum spin Hall effect form these large two-dimensional reservoirs and induce backscattering. And another possibility is that a condo impurity is induced by some potential fluctuation. And so right now it's not completely sure which mechanism is actually the one which causes the suppression or the decrease of conductance in large samples. But if we do measurements with a local tip perturbation, we might be able to distinguish between the two mechanisms. If it's a 2D reservoir, it'll we'll get some kind of an additional contact, so a 2D reservoir, which then leads to an equilibration of the counterpropagating states. And then if we go to the Landau-Bruniker formalism, we can directly predict at which value we'll end up in terms of the conductance if we perturb the edge states on one side of the sample, if we take a two-terminal measurement between the left and the right-hand side. On the other hand, if we go to condo-like impurities, the scattering depends on the occupation of the impurity, because we need a single unpaired spin. And so we should see some oscillating behavior or modulation of the conductance as a function of the strength of the perturbation. And finally, if we should get a transition to the behavior as we see it for the large 2D reservoir. So in this sense, we can distinguish between the condo induced scattering and a 2D mechanism.
Do you know what is the size of the puddle that you tend to induce?
I think as a function of gate voltage, we can As we've seen in the gallium arsenide sample, they have a spatial resolution of tens of nanometers, which I guess is a lower estimate, because in gallium arsenide, if you deplete the 2D, you definitely get backscattering, which is not the case here in this sample. So we don't, at least for this 2D reservoir, we don't know exactly which size we'll need to, so that there are enough states in the...
Yeah, but what do you expect? The tip size and
the... I think, the tips, the separation of the tip from the 2D is of the order of 100 nanometers. So then we should roughly end up with a comparable size for the perturbation in the 2D. Then it depends.
But if you have a puddle that has one electron, then it can be smaller. And even if the perturbation has a full path length of 100 or 150 nanometers, if you may, over most of that perturbation, you may remain within the gap.
And so...
Can I go back to...
Yeah, sure.
Why is the saturation at 2/3 of this glow edge?
If we go to the lambda Bidu formalism and say that, okay, we have source here and a drain contact here, and then we just induce, add some large contact here and do lambda Bidu formalism for a two-terminal measurement between these two contacts, then we can end up with 2 E squared over 3H, if I didn't mess up the math somewhere on the way. Just adding,
from the left to the middle is 3 squared, the way from the middle to the right is 3 squared.
And then you have a parallel channel. Okay, so once we have... Did I get the numbers wrong for the two-terminal measurement? It might be.
I don't see the logic, but maybe we should go back.
Yeah, okay. So the first thing one then can do, if actually a tip induces some backscattering, is a spatial mapping of the edge states. And to do so, we can use a regular, more or less regular, atomic flux microscopy as a complementary technique. And since we're using an AFM tip to induce a perturbation, we can do in situ comparison of the transport results to the sample properties to see whether the actual edge of the sample is. And if we want to do some profile of the edge, for example, with a high resolution, we can go to a room temperature AFM, which is more convenient to go for high resolution. Then, on the other hand, the details of the scattering might affect the results that we get for these spatial maps. For the quantum purity, the question is how close to the edge states one has to get this unpaired spin to get the interaction. And for the 2D island, one of course needs a critical size to induce backscattering, which then might affect the spatial resolution. But in either case, one would expect some upper limit for the spatial resolution and for the position of the edge states. So if we keep the opposite edges far away from each other, one should at least be able to clearly distinguish between transport and the edge states and nothing going on in the bulk of the sample. In a more detailed study of the scattering, then one can address questions like how sensitive are the edge states to the potential fluctuations? Do we really need some kind of two-dimensional some puddle where the conduction rate minimum is below the Fermi energy, so that a 2D puddle or a quantum purity can be formed, or is it enough to get some small deformation of the energy landscape? And then there are several experimental knobs or parameters one can turn to address this question, like the strength of the induced potential fluctuations, the shape, which can be varied by the tip height or the position of the Fermi energy. And at the same time, one can then see what's the dominant mechanism behind the scattering. On the other hand, one might get information about the intrinsic properties of the samples. For example, we have a sample where the conductance is slightly below 2 E squared over H. Then one can use the tip perturbation to remove such an intrinsic perturbation and then get closer to the quantized value as it is expected from theory. And that, even more possibilities open up if one applies a magnetic field. And as already shown in the introduction part, for a magnetic field, one gets a suppression of the conductance, but usually there's no full suppression of the conductance, but still some residual conductance at finite magnetic field. And if one goes to high magnetic fields, a re-entrant quantum Hall-like state can be observed with a quantized Hall conductance and zero longitudinal conductance. In cartoon-like pictures, one can connect these two states, the quantum spin Hall state and the quantum Hall state. If we start from the energy spectrum at zero magnetic fields, we get the counterpropagating quantum spin Hall edge states. And if we then increase the magnetic fields, the bulk states, which lead to the edge states, are shifted accordingly to the Lambda level dispersion. So that for this particular case, the blue state at first crosses the Fermi energy, so that only the red state crosses the Fermi level and causes edge states. And then finally, at high magnetic fields, both states have been shifted across the Fermi energy, and the Fermi energy is in the gap over the entire width.
So let me just make a comment.
Yes.
This picture is very similar to what Patrick and Stefan discussed earlier, right?
Yeah.
So here in this picture does occur, these two things, and that's because of the band inversion. Right? So usually you draw an upward parabola and downward Lambda level, but because of the band inversion, this phenomena does occur in the inverted quantum. And so then you go from one, so this is one type of insulator, this is the other type, but by going applying magnetic field, you can go from one to the other.
Excuse me, about the picture on the left.
Yes.
Can you look at the graph and conclude that these two counter-propagating modes actually get, to some extent, spatially separated when you have you apply magnetic field?
This might well be so. That's one of the questions we'd like to see in the scanning guide microscopy, because if we say that these two counterpropagating states move spatially apart, then at some point we won't be able to connect them with a kind of 2D puddle, for example, and get backscattering. So at some point we should lose the ability to get backscattering, or to have to apply a larger tip voltage to get backscattering. So this might be seen in the scanning experiments.
But then the question might be, by the time you reach that point, would there be some kind of like a, then locally you have some kind of like a current flow, so I mean, would that point of separation, by the time that point of that separation happens, would you be actually able to probe that by some measuring the magnetic field?
So
Could you detect, not in a spin-sensitive way, but just the field produced by the current that's flowing, if you have a current that's flowing in each direction and they're separated laterally?
Okay.
Could you detect that field?
Could we detect that field? I don't know right now how easily this can be done, but I guess one should clearly see a signature in transport if these edge states are separated in there, so that backscattering without external perturbation is limited or even completely suppressed. You all want that question? Okay.
Are you close to wrapping up?
Yes, pretty close. Okay. And so, yeah. One thing that happens in a magnetic field is that the time rebuffered symmetry is broken, so that we should be able, or should we be much more sensitive to external perturbations. So then in a magnetic field, even if it's just a small magnetic field, where the spatial effect on the shift of the precision of the edge states can be neglected, we might be able to get a better information about the positioning of the edge states. And at the same time, one should be able to clearly connect these two phenomena, the quantum spin Hall state at zero magnetic field and the re-entrant quantum Hall effect at finite magnetic field, by mapping the position of the edge states as a function of magnetic field. Another thing we might look into is using a magnetic perturbation, commercial tips as they are used for magnetic force microscopy, provide a field of the order of 10 or several 10 millitesla, which is comparable to the field which is required to suppress the conductor of the quantum spin Hall state. And there again, one can then see how sensitive the states are to a local magnetic field. And that's all the most of the experiments we are thinking to do right now. And then we'll see maybe within the next few months how well these experiments actually work out. Thanks very much.
I have a question about this affine. What is the number of edge states? It's double.
Yeah, it's four times. It's
four.
This, right?
So
it's four times this.
So that two is zero, not one. So it's not like here when Z2 is 1. In that case, Z2 will be 0.
The edge state only occur when you have a field.
Okay.
A quantum spin Hall is only defined when you don't have a field.
Fine. So, but the number of edge states is double, so you allow scattering. I mean, they are not protected by this number.
So let's thank Marcus and Nagos.
I must be very careful. Okay. Okay. So first of all, I would like to thank the organizers. And okay. So today I want to talk about some new proposal for the new materials. And if the time allows, I want to also talk about some possible new experiments. So here is my collaborators. So there are two my students, and we are collaborating with the Su Chang group. And this is for some junction problem. So Tanaka-san is a professor in Nagoya University, and Sasha Baratsky, Los Alamos. So I think I want to talk about this d electron systems. Because I think the next direction of a quantum spin Hall system is interplay between the correlation and topology. So from that viewpoint, I think that the electron is very promising and important. So that's why I want to address these issues in this talk. So if the time allows, I want to also talk about some possible spin transport measurement for the junction systems between the quantum spin Hall systems and metal. So this is a very naive introduction to the d orbitals. And actually, this d orbitals is not so different from the p orbital from a viewpoint of the orbital angular momentum. So especially if we have dxy, yz, and zx orbitals, so these orbitals behave just like p orbitals. So for example, if you make a matrix element of orbital angular momentum within this three-dimensional space, it is exactly like a p orbital. But here is a sign change. So you have a minus sign in this case. So that's why the effective spin-orbit coupling has a reverse sign. So in the case of p orbitals, you have a positive sign. But in the case of d orbitals, you have a negative sign. So this sign change is clearly seen if you look at the band structure of strontium titanium oxide compared with gallium arsenide. For example, this is a very well-known band structure for the gallium arsenide. So you have conduction valence band made of p orbitals. And these p orbitals the 6-4 degenerate because you have 3p bands and spin 1/2. And this one is further split into the double degenerate spin split band and heavy hole band and light hole band. So this corresponds to the J is 3/2, and this is the J is 1/2. The similar structure is here for the titanium oxide, right? So if you look at this band structure, this is the bottom of the d orbitals, and this one is made from these 3 orbitals. So basically you have a 6-4 degenerate band for the split by the spin of coupling, and this is J is effectively 1/2, and this is 3/2. So you have a 4-4 degeneracy. So that's why we expect the d orbital is also play a very important role in the spintronics and also quantum spin hole systems. And of course, our main concern is the electron correlations. And here is a series of the 3D elements. And we have many magnetic materials in this. The reason is that you have a very strong electron-electron correlation for these 3D transition metals. And if you are going to the heavier and heavier atoms, like a 4D and 5D series, so there is a clear tendency. Because the orbital, d orbital, is more and more extended if you go to the 4D and 5D. So that means the electron correlation is reduced because of the larger extent of a wave function. But on the other hand, because the element gets heavier, so the strong spin orbit coupling gets stronger and stronger. And in the 3D transition metal oxide, typically U is a 5 or 10 electron volt and very big. And the spin orbit coupling is typically 20 or 30 milli electron volt. So this one is much, much smaller compared with the U. But eventually, if you go to this 5D, so both spin orbit and the electron correlation becomes the same order, of the order of 0.5 electron volt. So that's why in this 5D element, we expect the interesting interplay between the electron correlation and the spin orbit coupling. So that's why I'm now interested in this 5D elements. Especially today, I want to focus on this iridium atoms. So this is some cartoon, the schematic picture I borrowed from Dr. Kim. The picture is the following. So under the octahedral coordinations of the oxygen, so the d orbital is split into the EG band and the T2G band. So the T2G band is XYYZZX, as just described. So if you put the electron correlations, then usually the correlation gives you the Hubble gap by the electron repulsion U.
So it's, why upper and lower bands are asymmetric?
Oh, okay, because I'm talking about this iridium 4 plus. Then you have 5D, 5. You have electron number 5. So you have only one hole in the T2G orbitals. So that's why your hole is occupying this upper Hubble band, and your electron is occupying this. So I focus on this iridium 4 plus, which is realized in this material. Okay, so this is a conventional picture. But what happens is quite different from this conventional picture. Namely, because of the spin orbit coupling is rather strong. So you have a splitting between the J is 1/2 and J is 3/2 first. And then this J is 1/2 bands shows a rather narrow energy dispersion. And you put the U on top of this J effective 1/2, then you have a Hubble splitting between this upper Hubble band and lower Hubble band. So that means the electron correlations together with the spin orbit coupling collaborate to make the system insulating. So this is a highly relativistic Mott insulator. And actually, as I will show you so later, so these energy scales are comparable. And more explicitly, these wave functions are just given by this linear combination of X, Y, Y, Z, and Z, X orbitals. So the wave function looks like this. So this is a combination of this L is 0 and L is 1 wave functions, and looks like this. So this is a doublet structure.
The question is, typically for such a kind of 5D element, this kind of lattice distortion also very strong. It's strongly coupled with D reduction. So what happens here for the structure?
Yeah, actually, there are rotations of this octahedral.
That will also break this three-fold degeneracy.
Yeah, but because of the spin orbit is rather strong, so this picture survives approximately.
I think this rotation also contributes to energy scale, something like 0.2 or 0.3.
Yeah, but you can define this G effective in this rotated frame.
But once you rotate, this already breaks your three-fold rotation symmetry. You have degeneracy of x, y, y, z, z, three-fold degeneracy.
Yeah.
Well, once this rotate happens, already this degeneracy was broken.
But that splitting is still smaller than this single coupling I did. Okay, so the important point is that here you have a complex wave function. Okay, this picture has been confirmed by the X-ray absorption spectroscopy by this. So the main idea is that because the wave function has an equal weight over x, y, y, z, and gx orbitals, then this ratio can be detected experimentally by the polarization dependence of the X-ray absorption. And also this energy scale can be estimated from the optical conductivity. So this concluded the same order of magnitude of a Coulombic U and the spin orbit coupling. Okay, with this basis, we are confirmed that for this iridium oxide, so you have this J effective 1/2 and the complex orbitals, and you have oxygen. So then you can map the problem into the effective tight binding model with the Coulombic U. So the most important feature of this Hamiltonian is if you consider the transfer integral between these complex orbitals and the p orbitals, then you get some complex phase. And this phase is spin dependent. Right? So if you have a positive theta, you have a negative theta for the downspin. So this gives you some distributions of complex transfer integral within the materials. So then you can design the distribution of this gauge flux, which is independent in the material. So this is the way I want to design the materials for the quantum spin hole systems.
So by spin, you mean the total spin, like orbital and spin combined?
Exactly, J effective, 1/2. Okay, so then we encounter a very interesting structure materials. It is a sodium to iridium O3. So this material structure is like this. So this is a sodium, and this is a octahedron with the iridium atoms at the center, and this red one is oxygen. Right. And then this iridium is surrounded by the oxygen, and you can define the local coordinate to the direction of oxygen. So this is a small x, small y, small z. So this forms a network of the honeycomb lattice. And this reminds me of Haldane model and also the Kane-Mele model. And actually, I will show you that this leads to the exactly the Kane-Mele model in the tight binding. So before doing that, we are also working on some first principle band calculation on these materials. And this is before the spin orbit coupling is introduced. So we can clearly see the structure, level structure. So the oxygen is here, and the T2g orbitals and the eg orbitals are clearly split. And near the Fermi energy, so the electric state is mainly coming from the T2g. So that's why we expect the effect of the spin orbit quite effective in these states. near the Fermion. And if we further put the spin orbit coupling, so we also clearly see the splitting between the J effective one half state and the J 53 half states. So the, this is the Fermi energy, and then the states near the Fermi energy is mainly made of J effective one half. So this everyday calculation, this gives you the metal because you have a finite density of state. But the real material is insulator. So that's why we construct some effective.
How large is the gap?
So actually, Hide Takagi has the data, but he forbids me to tell that. But yeah, he actually is very afraid of a tough competitor in United States. Insulator. And actually,
well,
this
material. Yeah. The formula that's all it matters.
Yeah, actually, our estimate for the gap is typically the room temperature order.
So z direction column is spin independent. Is that right?
Yeah, z direction dispersion is very very small. Actually, we write the dispersion along the c axis because the c axis dispersion is blocked. By this sodium.
Oh.
So then the very good two-dimensional electron structure.
Yeah, but so very small d direction tunnel is spin dependent or v dependent?
I think it is spin independent.
Spin independent.
Yeah. Okay. So then we have a clear splitting, right? So then we are safely make a tight binding model for this manifold, J effective one half.
So I'm saying that this U will open a gap and one of the complex states will be occupied.
Yeah, that issue I'm now discussing with this person. But probably, if I understand correctly, this LDA always underestimates the gap, right? And probably GW or something will open the gap.
So experimentally, clearly.
Yeah, experimentally it is insulating, and we have a large window of temperature. We are this material is insulating, but non-magnetic.
GW will overestimate.
Yeah. So the reality is in between. Okay, so this is a one-page picture of our rather tough calculation. So actually, this structure, you can consider the many, many paths of the transfer between the neighboring and the next nearest neighboring iridium atoms, right? And if you look at this nearest neighbor pairs, actually this is a 90-degree bond. So this will be actually very important in the later discussion because in this case, so there are two parts, two oxygens related to this bond, right? So then there occurs some cancellation of a conducting path. So that means PD square over ED minus EP, this process canceled out. Then we need to go to the higher order hopping process, and eventually we end up with this T and T prime corresponding to the nearest neighbor hopping and the next nearest neighbor hopping. For the nearest neighbor hopping, this is boring. So you just have a spin independent hopping. But if you calculate the next nearest neighbor hopping, it is spin dependent and also complex. So that's why this is quite similar to Haldane model in the spin-dependent version, and actually quite similar to the KML model. And we can estimate the order of magnitude of these parameters and typically the room temperature.
So can you argue from symmetry that it had to be that way? I
mean, yeah, actually this quantization. Yeah, probably we can say, but this quantization axis, right? So this x and y and z actually correspond to the direction of oxygen measured from the iridium atoms.
Okay.
So it looks like this direction. So the quantization axis depends on the direction of the hopping. So you can map this model into this 4x4 Hamiltonian. Right. And here is a table I borrowed from Hu Kane's paper. And according to this parity analysis at the high symmetry point, we can conclude that this system, this tight winding model, belongs to the topological insulator. But this is a two-dimensional system, that means a weak topological insulator. And we can also construct an effective model near the K point and the K prime point. And this one is can be written by the massive Dirac fermions. You can discuss the Z2 number from this and also consistent with the topological insulator. And also, we checked that for the finite length of width of a stripe, you have a helical edge channel crossing a pi.
So was the rule of U simply to give you an insulator?
Yeah, so actually, our picture is U is not that large. Then we are starting from the band picture and put the U afterwards. And actually, the effect of the U is following. So our picture is following. First, we have an insulator, right? Then we have a helical edge channel at the surface. Then if you put the U, so the anti-ferromagnetic instability occurs first at the surface of the sample. And you have some surface anti-ferromagnetism if you reduce the temperature. And if you further reduce the temperature, so that everything becomes, bulk becomes anti-ferromagnet. So we expect a two-stage phase transition for the anti-ferromagnetism.
But then shouldn't there be a translational symmetry breaking? Like, is there neutron scattering?
The sample is still very small, 50 micrometer or something like that. So the neutron is not available.
In this case, your surface states are not necessarily stable.
Yeah, because of the weak topological insulator, right? So that's why we claim that if you have this kind of structure, then here is an even odd effect. So if you have only one layer on top of this bulky state, then you have a helical edge channel running here.
What is that layer?
Oh, this is a kind of a step, right?
Oh, you mean the surface termination?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're considering defects.
Yeah, but actually, the dispersion around the C-axis is very small, very, very small. So that's why even though you have two Dirac fermions at the Kz is a pi and Kz is zero, I think the dispersion is very small.
Does this also cleave?
Again, Hidetaka. For me. Sure, please directly ask him.
Scotch tape,
So your scenario is that the antiferromagnetism happens in the surface state, or in the edge state first.
Yeah, edge state first. Yeah, because it is...
You have to gap it.
Yeah. I understand.
Is there any evidence of gapless mode, say like NMR or something?
No, at the moment, no. So this is our proposal for the STM, right? If you put the needle on this side, so you have clearly the gap, and this gap is typically room temperature order. But if you put the needle near the edge of this step, then at room temperature, for example, so you have a finite density of state. But because of this H anti-ferromagnetism, you open the gap.
So, but why even use a step? You could just look on the side.
The corner edge.
If it can just odd number, even number.
Even odd.
Well, it doesn't matter if it's even, it's perfectly nested. So, so it doesn't matter what.
Just the corner.
Yeah. So for the finite density of state, I think it's okay. Right?
That linear expected for graphene, the boundary anti-ferromagnetic moment.
The graphite is, of course, but there is some boundary magnetic field for graphene case. Mm-hmm. The situation can be quite similar.
So what do you mean this antiferro? Is this an interlayer antiferro or within the layer antiferro?
Within the layer antiferro.
Within the layer. Yeah. But this is a triangle lattice, so there's some kind of frustration.
No. Honeycomb. Right. There is no frustration.
Since in Moria type, antiferro magnetic is changing, is it possible to cause some frustration?
Yeah, actually, in the mean field levels, we have some magnetic anisotropy, which is preferred within the XY plane. But the difference is very tiny. So the magnetic anisotropy in the weak coupling limit is very tiny. But as for this Gerasimsky-Moria type interaction, we have not yet studied. But actually, I will show you more interesting stuff in the next slide.
So the conclusion is depending on what face you look at, you either have an antiferromagnet or not, right?
Yeah.
Is that?
Okay. So I'm talking about the bulk antiferromagnet. Is XY plane easy plane anisotropy?
Yeah, suppose the temperature is higher than the Neo temperature.
Yeah.
Do you think it's easier to see the edge state?
Yeah, I think we see something like that. Okay, but this is a weak coupling picture. But recently there appeared an interesting paper by Guinette Carulin, who is talking about a strong coupling limit. So you start from a large U limit and then part up with respect to a transfer integral. Then you can construct an effective Heisenberg model and to see what is the Heisenberg type Hamiltonian. So he considered the two possibilities. One is a 180 bond, degree bond, and the other is a 90 degree bond. So let me focus on this 90 degree bond because this is relevant to this sodium compound. He found that it is very Ising, right? But this gamma depends on the direction of the bond, right? So, and this one is non-zero only when you have a Hund's coupling. So the JH is a Hund's coupling, and the U is a Coulombic interaction. And this J is a ferromagnetic Ising type interaction. But the interesting stuff is this gamma depends on the direction of the bond. For example, this is a 2-1-3 structure, and depending on this direction of the bond. So sometimes it is a XX, and sometimes it is a ZZ, and sometimes a YY. So this pattern is actually exactly the Kitaev model.
Is it for spin?
For spin.
So the quantization orthogonal to each other, this model for the B.
B?
Yes. So this quantization X is orthogonal to each other.
Yeah, so this quantization axis is exactly which I defined here. So it's defined in this way, x, y, z. Measuring from the iridium to the oxygen atoms. So you can define the x, y, z in the spin space also.
So I have a model which is in also with p orbitals in the hexagonal lattice, which looks a little similar to the quantization axis. They are related to 120 degrees,
which has
a kind of
motion. Not the 120 degree. In this case, it is orthogonal,
XYZ. The system is a three-dimensional system or quasi-two-dimensional?
Quasi-2D, in this case.
Yeah, it's just two layers, right? It's quasi-2D, but the atoms are sitting in two different planes.
Is it bilayer quasi-2D, or...?
Yeah, I think I'm talking about the two-dimensional honeycomb like this, right? So that is this quasi-2D, not the double layer. So if you look at these configurations around the iridium atom and with the oxygen coordination, so then you can pick up this oxygen in this way. So this is iridium distribution, and every iridium atom sharing the two oxygens with a 90 degree bond. And So here you can define the axis, which is orthogonal to this plane. So that is the quantization direction of this Ising type interaction.
Is this system as the same as yours, the same compound?
Yeah, this is the same compound, but he's talking about the strong coupling limit. So we are talking about the weak coupling band picture. So completely different limit.
But in your model, that the nearest neighbor Hawking is spin independent.
Okay, so yeah. Okay, so in that case, we neglect the Hund coupling. If you put the Hund coupling to be zero, so this disappears. So in that sense, this is consistent. There appears a cancellation. But because of this Hund coupling, you have some finite exchange interaction.
I can imagine that your Hawking, which is independent, is dominant. So what's your
So he's talking about the T square over U process, right?
Yes.
So but I'm talking about the higher order process in my band structure calculation. Right. So I need a PP transfer and the PD pi interaction. So we are talking about the higher order process for this band structure.
Which one can dominate?
Yeah, that's the question. So probably in this parameter space, we can continue this band picture and to this Kitaev model picture. So I think that is a very interesting problem for the theorist, namely, what is the global diagram, including both this topological insulator and quantum spin liquid state. I think because the Heinrich lattice has two atoms in the unit cell. So I think you can adiabatically continue this spin model into the band insulator. So that's why probably we can connect these two limits in the global phase diagram. But what is not so clear to me is about this helical edge channel. Do we have a helical edge channel for the Kitaev model or not?
But
then he would have Majorana fermions.
Kitaev
model
is Majorana fermions. Yeah. But that is
different
from that. Until you put a T-breaking field.
Right. Kitaev. Yeah. Kitaev's Honeycomb model.
You have to put the magnetic field.
Right.
To get a Majorana.
Yeah. But in quantum spin core, nobody managed to get Majorana unless you put superconductor. Right. So if there's a smooth connection, it would be very interesting. That's one of the most interesting questions.
Yeah, exactly.
How Majorana can occur in
the material. Yeah, but my feeling is that the Majorana appears only when you break the U1 symmetry, namely the superconductivity.
But Kitaev model is a spin model.
There's no U1 symmetry there, right?
Yeah.
U1 symmetry is a charge sector, right? I mean, yeah. Your model, D2 symmetry of the Majorana fermion is in the spin line.
Yes, yeah, but just to see the Majorana fermions in the real world, do you need superconductivity?
Yeah, I do.
That's
the Majorana fermion there is a spin line, right? Carries a D2 gauge charge. I mean, it's not a real quantum quantum system.
Transverse field Ising model has Majorana fermions.
But that's not local.
Yeah.
That's not some non-local
situation.
So how stable are these solutions if you add, say, a second order, inter-site coupling?
So Coulombic interaction.
Yeah, longer range.
What I can say is that
in real materials, you always have higher order exchange and higher order is a finite term. Is it ultra sensitive to? Is ground state ultra sensitive to?
Yeah, of course, it depends on the gap size. When the Coulombic that interaction is a smaller than gap.
That's why I was asking about gap.
So. Yeah, at the moment, this is typically this room temperature, so may not be so robust.
Like that.
Yeah.
I think that probably is okay. If that physics is not stable, since the Newton is also a higher order.
Yeah.
So Kalinin model is kind of quite fragile. It's maximally degenerate. If you add any perturbation, probably will ruin all these physics. Your model with the spin independent hopping, like a Kalinin model, you put the type, some kind of Heisenberg type uniform perturbation.
Yeah.
You select one of probably usual anti-ferromagnetism within the overall other state.
I'm talking about this path for the transfer integral. Yeah, but we correct all the possible paths up to this third order. So we do not pick up arbitrarily. So we correct all the possible paths. So yeah, within this tight binding model, I think that one is great.
So I still think that probably your term is more dominant
than this. Sorry?
Your term, the third order.
Yeah, third order. Yeah.
Probably
you're dominant
over this
type of
physics, finally.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I agree that we have a good chance that the U physics is much more important than this band structure. But probably we can argue with adiabatic continuations.
So ignoring the higher order terms is. Yeah. Is there a phase transition in going from insulator to spin liquid, or it's crossover?
Yeah, that's the question.
Ignore the higher order terms.
Yeah, that's the question I'm posing here. I have no answer at the moment.
I think that's a good note to pose and thank and not to. In terms of themes that have, I don't want to hold this too long, but in terms of themes that have come up here, it seems like the robustness of the excitations at the edges is something that is interesting, and would be interesting to think about how similar is that in these different realizations, the D wave versus I guess even going over to graphene and the 2D quantum spin hall. What what does it take to kill the edge states either in 2D or in 3D into different realizations? And I think that we've seen ideas for experiments to try to probe that with local probes, but also in the in what Kwanong talked about at the end of Zahid's talk, we heard about ways to try to probe in the 3D system these edge states, and it's clear that in order to really probe the behavior of a single face in a 3D system, you would have to have a way to kill to prevent conduction through the other faces. So I wonder whether anyone's interested in commenting on might it be possible to prevent conduction in a 2D system, let's say through one edge but not the other, in a 3D system through some of the faces. So if you have the insulator, if you're looking at the bismuth antimony compound, and you have a bulk insulator, and you're making your measurements on different materials with different aspect ratios, different dimensions, would it be possible to imagine measuring conductance that's just across one face as opposed to across all of the faces?
Measuring one surface
so you evaporated iron, you found you induced a gap. Should it be possible? So this is something that Yuval already suggested. Should it be possible to induce a gap on some faces but not on others, and then measure the remaining gapless modes?
Well, one possibility that I we haven't implemented it, but if you evaporate a Corbino disk on one face, right, with the electrode in the center, so this would be a two probe measurement.
Yeah.
And if the bulk were conducting, then it would be hopeless. Right? If it were partially insulating, especially at low temperature, then all the current will actually flow to the central electrode, and the alternate path would be much, much more resistant. That's a question of beating the geometry, whether this would ever compete well with the bulk.
Yeah.
But that was something I was trying to play with, but we need to actually reduce the bulk conductivity somehow. Or some way to tune it, you know, so that you can be sure that you're simply picking up the
But it seems like when you looked in your different geometries that the bulk conductivity was indeed made small compared to the residual conductivity at very low temperatures.
In the experiments I described? Yeah, but that is just a, it's not a proof. It is just systematic variation. So hopefully in one of these smaller samples, if I then evaporate a Corbino disk, wondering if that would, but I don't know. I was hoping to hear some thoughts and theories on what we should do.
In the case of graphene, we have suggested you can introduce a local gate to introduce a backscattering on one edge,
yeah,
and then,
yeah,
then you will create a spin filter. But only one spin filter will go. So I think even in the topologic insulator, you can evaporate a patch of magnetic impurity on one side. Then you can create a spin filter. And the question is how you detect it.
Because you block the one side?
Yeah, one spin will be reflected, but the other side is not.
Do you need any magnetic field or just these paddles that you induce?
Hmm?
Maybe that would be sufficient, these paddles.
Paddle?
I mean, with the...
Well, you need to... Yeah, you need to destroy this thing somehow. I mean,
somehow,
the topological inserts are more robust. Graphene is easier to destroy.
Could you just have a longer path length on one side? I mean,
no, the spin, you know, because you've right.
If you
backscattering on one side.
You just have two; they're closer together, and then you have a long path length. I mean, it isn't a perfect conductor at finite temperature, right? Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, you mean by introducing an elastic scattering?
Yeah. So, you know, if one side is really long,
right,
then its conductance is
well,
really small.
Or you can just put some
dirt. What Lawrence's experiments did in the non-local.
We do it in Michigan.
In the non-local edge measurements.
It's
maybe harder to imagine how to do that in three-dimensional materials than in two dimensions. But. So, any other comments or discussion? So if not, I guess.
So now to you, you had also some other experimental proposal you didn't get to, right?
Yeah, but I think that
maybe next year, maybe you can volunteer again, maybe others.
I'm leaving tomorrow.
Oh.
Well, Kagi has insisted that he leaves.
What time is the wine and cheese party? Is it 4:30?
At 5:00.
Five.
Let's hear it.
Well, why don't we have time? Why don't we? I would like to hear it.
Actually, we are started out from the spin turn. So our first motivation was the spin current. And then I think we should look at the spin transport properties for the quantum spin hole system. So that is my comment. So for that purpose, I think I want to propose the junction in the quantum spin hole system and normal metal. And of course, here we have helical edge channels or helical edge modes running depending on the spins. So how we can detect this helical edge channel. So that is my motivation. So then we did a very simple student problem for the junction between the quantum spin hole systems and the metal. Right? So here is the film energy, and here is the gap. And inside the gap, you have a helical channel. And this system can be described by this 4x4 Hamiltonian, which has been given in the review article by Tony Etra. And then this model has a very nice feature that you can tune the usual insulator and the quantum fixing Hall effect, depending on the sign of the mass. Right? And then we put the mass to be zero on this metallic side. Right? So then we have a metal quantum fixing Hall junction, or the metal usual insulator junction. So you can compare the two cases. And then what we discuss is
the usual metal is not described by m equals to 1. That's a Dirac metal.
Yeah, but this is doubly degenerate, but because we are Fermi energy is shifted, right? So then this is doubly degenerate. Yeah, you are right. But this is a kind of conventional metal. So then what we discuss is rotation angle of the spin. So if you inject the spins and reflect back, then you have some change of the spin angle. So this spin angle we call the alpha. So we just calculate this alpha as a function of the incident angle theta and also this m mass. So this is what we did. So this is a result. Actually, this has several interesting features. So the first, it has a very sharp peak. By the way, because of the time reversal symmetry, this theta goes to minus theta, then alpha goes to minus. So because if you trace back this reflection, then the alpha becomes minus alpha, right?
So is it kind of like Andreev reflection? In a way?
Hmm?
Is it kind of like
Andreev
reflection in a way?
No, I will go to that point. So this is insulator and metal.
Yeah, I know.
No other.
I know, but you know, if you write down the Hamiltonian, the basis would be that different whether you're thinking
about
superconductor.
No, different. There is no current. Usually in the Andreev reflection, you have a supercurrent, right? Mm-hmm. But in this case, you have no. There is no current inside because this is a gap. But here you have a helical channel, so then something happens. So that is this peak structure of this rotating angle. So you have a very big spin rotation when you hit the helical channel. Namely, this is a dispersion of the helical channel. And then if you can tune this incident angle, then sometimes you get a very big spin rotation. So this is a resonance. So we propose this one way to detect the dispersion of the helical edge channel. So if you can tune this incident angle accurately, then you have this nice.
How do you do that?
Right?
How do you tune the incident angle?
Yeah, some geometry, I guess.
So
using ballistic transport of
the channel.
Which angle is that?
Yeah. Okay.
Is the rotation of the spin.
So this theta times kf. You can define the k, right? So the theta, sine theta times kf gives you the ky. So when the ky hits this point, then you have a big spin rotation.
So how do you measure the spin rotation?
I mean, so I use a spin injector and a spin detector.
Yeah.
So you have to inject spin polarized.
Yeah, you need a spin polarized.
So what if you had ordinary edge states? Are you predicted? So yeah. I guess by looking through all the angles, you can tell that there are two?
Yes.
So you could tell an even number from an odd number. I mean, this would happen even if you had an even number of edge states, right?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, but in that case, in general, you have a gap, right? You have a gap.
What?
For the even number, generic, right? Then you need a.
Not necessarily. Huh? I mean, I guess if they're localized by disorder, but you could have.
Yeah, but for this positive M side, you have no edge channel, so you have no structure. But probably you are right that you have
an
even number.
It doesn't even matter if they're local. I mean, this is just sensitive to having states.
I think in the gap,
and that could happen, right? I mean.
No. I think probably you need this edge channel should be quite spin polarized, right? This one is a spin up, and this is spin down. So that is important. Right.
But you could have an even number of pairs of those, though, right?
Yeah, that would.
I mean, as long as you have a spin orbit interaction, you're going to have the. They're going to be spin polarized, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but let me see. Other than this helical edge channel, do you expect a very large spin polarization for the edge channel?
If there's a spin orbit interaction, I mean, they'll be split, right?
Yeah.
So.
And for this 2D that you would couple to, most likely there wouldn't be spin orbit coupling. But that can also be worked out directly.
But from what you're saying, though, you'd be able to distinguish whether there's an even number or an odd number. Is that
No, I'm not saying that. If it is zero, right, nothing happened. But it is...
I see. So if you have two pairs of those, then you wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
Yeah. But sometimes this alpha winds 4 pi. So here you have a peak and become zero for the... pi is zero, and then becomes a negative and has a peak. But sometimes you wind up by 4 pi. So that means alpha could be very large. So this spin rotation could be very large. Okay, so now I want to make the quantum control system into the superconductor. So then I'm answering your question. Then once you have a superconducting quantum spin hole system, so what we claim is a non-central symmetric superconductor is a good candidate for that quantum P plus minus IP pairing state. Because in that case, you have this Rajiva type coupling, right? So then the singlet and triplet are mixed up because of this Rajiva coupling. So this is now a very exciting topic in the heavy selenium community. But we also have an interface superconductivity in the, this type of system. Then in this case, you expect this Rajiva type interaction. Then once this Rajiva type interaction is there, then you have a S and P type pairing state, and you can translate this pairing form into the chiral base, and you have a P plus minus IP type pairing state. But depending on the relative magnitude of the S wave pairing and P wave pairing, you have two distinct topologically different states.
So is there the possibility that the superconductivity occur in that the two-dimensional surface?
Yeah, already observed.
It's already
observed. Oh, okay. But the difficulty
is...
Is
this kind of long
form? No.
It started with that work, but it...
Yeah, but these are Triscon group. And several other groups already confirmed this.
They confirm superconductivity for the interface.
Yeah. But the difficulty is how localized.
At the interface.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the question is how localized near the interface. Mm-hmm. So maybe it is more extended towards the.
But recently they're gating measurements.
They're gating. Yeah. FET measurement also.
Oops, strong symmetric and superconductor in the bubble.
Yeah. Yeah. So this transition temperature is quite similar to the niobium dot.
So it could be
STO.
The doping.
Yeah. Identical. The doping was at least is almost identical.
Yeah, identical.
But they are both insulators.
Yeah, but you can have stuff.
I thought there was sort of a condition dependent. Sometimes the interface superconducts and sometimes it doesn't.
But now I think they can control very accurately this carrier density by the gating. And they have this doping dependence.
It's diffusion at the interface that makes
it. Diffusion of what?
I mean, the interface is not smooth. I mean, there's...
No, I think it is rather clearly defined. Very clearly defined, I think, this interface. And atomic scale product. Because original experiment by Harold Wong gives it a very high conductivity or mobility for this two-dimensional interface system. So this interface is atomically flat. But then, yeah, so how interface, I do not know. Maybe bulky superconductivity. Okay, but as a model, this is very, very defined, and you can talk about these topological properties of this non-central symmetric superconductor. And when the P wave pairing is bigger than this S wave, so this belongs to the same topological class, to the T plus minus IP, and naturally you have a pair of Majorana H modes. And yeah, this is from Fuchan's paper, and this is a cartoon for the edge channel for the helical superconductor. But of course, positive and negative energy states are related, and then this is a Majorana fermion. Then the question is how we can detect this helical edge channel by the some transport measurement. So the first thing I can imagine is a superconducting analog of Hall effect. So you put the superconducting current and measure, for example, the spin accumulation or the spin voltage. But it turned out that this effect is very, very small. And actually, several years ago, Akira revealed that this effect is reduced by the factor of k lambda square. So lambda is penetration depth. So then superconductivity is very bad from the viewpoint of the spin Hall effect. But if you see the this edge from the side by the junction between normal metal and superconductor, then you can talk about the Andreev reflection. So that gives you a very big effect. So again, we put the electron with the angle phi. Then if you hit this dispersion, then you hit observe the very large spin polarization of a supercurrent flowing in this circuit. So this is a superconductor. Then you have Andreev reflection, and you create a supercurrent. So this is one way to produce almost unity spin polarized current for this supercurrent. But of course, this angle-specific experiment should be very difficult. So that's why we propose another experiment, namely apply the relatively weak magnetic field. Then the balance between the upspin and downspin is broken because of the supercurrent. Then even the angle-integrated current has a very large spin polarization, which is given by this red curve. So this is nearly the 50% of spin polarization of the supercurrent is obtained by the relatively weak magnetic field of the order of 0.02 tesla. So this is a very reasonable range of the magnetic field. So actually, this effect is caused by the Doppler effect. So the Doppler effect is enhanced compared with the Zeeman effect. So this ratio is typically k lambda. So the same factor, k lambda, which is bigger than unity, enhances this spin current generation in this Andreev reflection.
Now, would you see the same enhancement in a P wave superconductor?
Broken chiral.
It's not in resonator. But that's different. That's
no, I don't know. But
yeah, that breaks already the time reversal symmetry, I think. Yeah. So the point here is this does not break the time reversal symmetry in the bulk, but a small magnetic field gives you a very big spin polarization of the superconducting current flowing this.
How about normal metal ferromagnetic insulator helical superconductor transistor? That would be ideal, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be the idea. Instead of this magnetic field, right? Yeah, I think similar. Similar. But what I need is orbital. But what I need is orbital magnetic effect, right? This is a Doppler.
Yeah, but not the Zeeman.
Mm.
Yeah, but you're talking about the exchange coupling, right?
Yeah.
If you put the magnetic, yeah. So this Doppler shift is essential for this. So this right going and left going has a different Fermi energy. So that is the origin of this big spin polarized current.
This current is the current of fermion or is a supercurrent of
quarks? Supercurrent.
Supercurrent of quark pairs.
Sorry?
So is the current of quark pairs, the bosonic sector, or the current of the H fermion, the bubble quasi particles?
No, no, no. Current is flowing in this way, not this way. So I put the circuit like this. Right? So you should look at the edge from the side, not along. So that is my claim. So if you consider this, then it is rather difficult to see the spin transport. But if you consider this transverse direction, the spin current is very easy to obtain. So that is my proposal.
I think that's all.
Does it have to be P plus IP? It can also be, I don't know.
Okay.
Have to be necessarily.
Yeah. So you are right. So actually what has been known about this non-central symmetric superconductor is the following. So this is a spinor, K up and K down, right? And you have this type of Hamiltonian only when you break the spatial inversion, because this time reversal and space inversion give you a condition. Then if both are satisfied, you have zero, lambda. But if you break this, then you could have this Rashbach coupling, right? And what has been known is once you have this Rashbach coupling, the most typical one is this case. It's a typical Rashbach interaction. And then once you have this interaction, within the P-wave pairing, so this P plus minus IP has a highest transition temperature. That is known. But of course, S-wave channel is also possible.
Okay.
So in general, you have a S-wave channel and P-wave channel.
Mm-hmm.
So and they coexist and mix because singlet and pair, triplet, you cannot distinguish because of the inversion symmetry breaking. Then you can talk about the relative magnitude of S-wave and P-wave. And there are two possibilities. So the one is the S-wave dominating, then it belongs to the conventional usual superconductor, and nothing happens. But when the P-wave channel is bigger, then you end up with this topological P plus minus IP.
The superconductor, these spins are below the Fermi level, right?
What do you mean by below that?
I mean, what I mean by that is that P plus IP will be gapped, fully gapped.
Yeah, fully gapped. In the bar.
Also, the spins you are drawing is not at the Fermi level.
This is before the pairing. So you open the gap everywhere.
Then it's not at the Fermi level anymore.
Yeah, so this is before the pairing. So you have a total gap, full gap. Yeah, the edge channel only appears as a massless.
I think your metal to quantum spin Hall insulator proposal in a way is kind of already measured by Lorentz, which we will talk about on Thursday.
It's the reverse of it.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so you should stay.
Really?
Yeah.
I see.
So he basically looks at the contact and he drives the current through a letter H. So he drives, he can apply a split gate. So that one side becomes quantum spin Hall, the other side is still metallic.
I see.
So then when he drives a current, you get spin current. And spin current goes into the metal and you measure that through inverse spin Hall.
I think
it's not directly like this, but it's kind of an integrated version.
Integrated version. I see. Yeah.
I think you've seen it already.
Yeah. The effect is the effect has been seen already.
I see. Yeah. But what I want to stress here is this resonance structure. If possible, then you can map this this version, the helical edge channel.
Yeah, that would be nice. So,
okay.
No further questions. Let's thank all the speakers.
So I think that's